Good afternoon. Welcome to Open Air, KALW's weekly radio magazine of the performing arts in the Bay Area. I'm Judith Seeger, sitting in this week for host David LaTulipe. Today, I will be talking with Susanna Martin and... Susanna Martin, Hilary Bettis, Bennett Fisher, and Nakisa Etemad from the Bay Area Playwrights Festival. Hilary, we'll start with you, please. We have the your play is called Queen of Basel, is that right?
That's correct.
And could you tell us about the genesis of this play?
Yeah. Well, first of all, I should say that the name just changed. It was Magic City like 2 days ago, which I think is probably part of the process. But in case people come and see it and they see Magic City, I just want them to know that it's now Queen of Basel. This place started as a commission by a theater in Miami that wanted to take a classic piece. So we took Miss Julie, Strindberg's Miss Julie, and wanted to turn it into a contemporary play for a bilingual audience. And so it has Spanish and English and Cuban and Venezuelan and Colombian and American.
Wow.
And so, yeah.
So how has the reading cycle informed the work?
It's been really exciting. I've definitely learned a lot about the play in the past week. This is like sort of unheard of to get to have two readings and get to have like 2 weeks to really dig into a play and learn about it in these settings. So we had a reading last week, and it was really interesting to hear like how the Spanish is working, how it's not working, what parts of the play people might be missing that they need, what parts, you know, we don't necessarily want the entire audience to be able to understand. And sort of going back into the room with Susanna, and who's an amazing director, and our amazing cast, and getting to dig back in and kind of recalibrate everything.
Did you say that there were parts you didn't want the audience to understand?
Well, there's parts that I don't want the English-speaking audience to understand that are like little like nods to the Spanish-speaking audience.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
All right. And what is the involvement of the actors in the process of the play development?
Actors are really like the backbone, I think, of a play development process. I mean, you know, everything on the page when you're writing it is theory and ideas until you get it into a room and you actually hear it coming out of people's mouths and you see, you know, actors have like great, great instincts, I think. Like, that's really what the talent of acting is. And so when they're in the moments and when their instincts are just kind of like flying, you know that you've done your work as a writer. And when they're stumbling and they're having lots of questions and things feel like they're not making sense to them, that's when you know you haven't done your homework yet and you have to go back in and figure out what actors are like tripping up on, what you're missing as a writer.
So a very, very collaborative process.
Yeah, it's very collaborative, which is I think what I love so much about theater.
Well, thank you. Susanna
mm-hmm.
Martin.
Yes.
You are the director on the development of this play.
Yes.
Could you tell us something about the development or the play?
Well, as Hilary said, the play is an adaptation of Strindberg's Miss Julie, set in Miami during Art Basel, which happens in Miami every year in December, and is sort of beyond being an art event, has become a bacchanalia, for lack of better words, which is appropriate for the theater. So Miss Julie, the original play, delved very much into class and gender. And what Hilary has brilliantly done with this play is bring in not just class and gender, but race, and the kind of intersection of those things, and the intersection of those things in contemporary America, in contemporary Miami. And what does it mean right now to come up against the structure of capitalism and the American dream? And what do people have access to based on their race, their class, and their gender? In terms of the development of this play, as Hilary was saying, it's been really interesting last week to kind of hear the play out loud for the first time, it's one thing to read it in your head. It's completely different to get to hear actors speak it. I felt like last week we were really delving into just kind of the overarching journey and the structure of the play. And this week we've had the opportunity to dig deeper into the characters and their relationships and what's at stake for them. And since it's so much a play about power and who has the power, diving into, okay, at every moment, who has that power and when does that switch and why?
That's really interesting. What what is the audience's role in the development process, or is there one?
Absolutely. Because one of the joys of doing new play development and doing readings such as this is that your audience comes in with a very different expectation. So I love developmental readings and I love workshops because the audience isn't expecting a final product. And so they're very much part of the collaborative process mm-hmm. with us. So we're often having post-show discussions where we're sitting down with them and talking about the play and asking them questions, asking them to ask us questions. And they just come into it with a completely different mind. What I love about that is, one, you get to get a sense of what is resonating for them, much like, you know, what's coming out of the actors' mouths easily, what isn't. For the audience, what are they immediately responding to or what's resonating with them and where are they like, I got a little lost there. And how does that inform the play? But also it just takes the veil off of what we as theater makers do. You know what I mean? It's like pulls the curtain back and says, like, yeah, this is how a play is made. This is how theater works.
Exactly.
Yeah.
It must be very inspiring to some people in the audience.
I think so. I think so. Yeah. And in our post-show discussion on Saturday, what was really wonderful to see was that it was a diverse audience of different people from different parts of the country, different ages, different races, people who seem to have a lot of familiarity with theater and people who don't. And so even just asking them a question about the Spanish in the play and hearing people say, I loved not knowing what was going on. I loved being uncomfortable. So it was cool. It was very cool.
Oh, very good. Thank you very much.
Sure.
We also here with playwright Bennett Fisher and Nikisa Itermat. Is that right?
Yeah.
Playwright, your play is called Damascus.
Yes.
And takes place on the road, involving a number of issues with high impact in these political, socially engaged times. Would you like to tell us some of the
Yeah, sure. I think the play's a bit of a mystery and a thriller, so it's challenging to talk about it without giving away too much of why to see it. But I do think that it looks at issues with race and class and privilege and the assumptions we make about one another. The protagonist is a super shuttle driver living in Minneapolis who realizes at the beginning of the play that he's really not going to be able to pay off his franchise, that he's living in a kind of state of permanent debt. And I think his desperation is just brought on by the realities of his job really is the catalyst for the whole drama. I think the play deals with domestic terrorism and xenophobia, but I think in a way that's a little more intimate and a little more personal maybe than some other plays that treat on the same subject. I really wanted to look at the private repercussions of large global issues, you know, not how that affects us nationally, but how that affects us individually. And most of the play is set in a super shuttle van, so it's very intimate. It's mostly just two characters trapped in this van traveling from Minneapolis to Chicago.
Can you talk about the evolution of the play?
Sure. Well, I wrote this play first when I was a graduate student at UC San Diego in the playwriting MFA program there. And I did a workshop production of it there with the MFA students. But it's been really great to get back to the table with it, you know, with other actors, just having – I have such a clear image of the production with the actors that originated the role, and it's great to hear other performers in that same position, and just how the language sounds differently, how an actor's rhythm or inflection really changes the meaning of the work. And it's been very nice to have this time where we can really open things up and explore different possibilities, because the play is headed to production in Chicago in the spring. So I feel like this is sort of like my, you know, my last chance really to dig into it in a significant way without the the pressure of an opening night, you know, looming ahead. And I think a lot has changed in these 2 weeks. As Hillary said, it's very unusual to go back into the room with the same team after an initial reading. And I've been very very inspired by the work that the team's doing, and I think it's just opened up really lovely things, especially in the latter half of the play, moving towards the end.
Oh, that's very exciting. Was it your intent to have the audience on the edge of the seat?
Well, I'd rather have them on the edge of their seat than dozing, you know, in the aisle. Yeah, I think so. I mean, I think that in many ways this is sort of a classic thriller. I mean, I was very inspired by the films of Hitchcock, by you know, kind of those novel, you know, noir novels where you're not really sure what's happening for a long time, and it takes you quite a while to actually piece together the significance of the events you're seeing. But yeah, there's something about the intimacy of theater that I think really, you know, if you, the audience, are physically trapped in the room with the actors, it's sort of immediate and visceral in a way that I don't think any other medium is. And I wanted to try to create that level of tension where you're, you know, where you hopefully both, like, want to keep watching but also want to get out and can't get out, but in an exciting way, like any good thriller or horror movie.
What role did race play in your choices?
I mean, I think race plays a huge role all the time, everywhere. I was some of the inspiration from the play came from when I was working on another play in Kansas City, and I had a super shuttle driver who'd emigrated from Somalia years ago, and he, what I didn't know at the time is that most super shuttle drivers are, you know, own their own franchise. They're not salaried employees. They own the van. They have a stake in the van, and they have to give some percentage of their earnings to the company, but it's their own business. And this guy had, you know, scrimped and staved and earned enough to put down a $15,000 deposit on buying his own van, and yet was really concerned that he wouldn't be able to sustain the amount of work to pay off that debt. And I don't know, just after talking with him, we actually ended up driving me to the hotel, and then we just sort of sat in the parking lot and talked as he was waiting for his next fare. And I was just really struck by you know, the way that we talk about the American dream and economic opportunity in the country and what that's actually like. This is someone who just bought wholesale into the idea of owning a small business, and I think has made all the right moves and was still struggling. And I think that we tell similar narratives around race and privilege. You know, there's an idea of equity that we'd like to believe, but, you know, the reality is we can't often get by our bias. So yeah, I think it's a big engine that the play works on.
And the failure of the American dream?
Yeah, I mean, I think that, you know, there's something to me. My great-grandfather came to this country and worked as a chauffeur for years, driving the Vanderbilt family around. And I think it's been very interesting, you know, thinking about, I don't know, my family, I think, is a proof that the American dream is possible, you know, going from immigrants who came with nothing to now, you know, having the luxury to work as a playwright and, you know, pursue what I love without necessarily worrying about how I'm going to sustain myself. But I do think that I'm more interested in the way that the narrative we tell ourselves about success, and the points in our lives where when we've finally gotten the thing we've been striving for, and yet it turns out not to be quite what it is. I think Damascus starts at a point in the character's life where he's actually achieved this thing he's been struggling for years, and yet is realizing that he, even though he has it, he probably can't hold on to it. And for me, that's a little more heartbreaking than striving and failing. It's that thing of actually getting
I agree,
what
yes.
you want. Yeah, and it's funny, you know, as Hillary and Suzanne are talking about Strindberg, I think it's actually like a very Strindberg-y like thing to talk about, not the struggle for something, but the dissatisfaction with having the thing that you're that's supposed to make you content.
Yeah, it's one of life's ironies, isn't it? The achieving the dream kills the dream.
Yeah, yeah.
Nakisa Etemad, is that
right? Yes, very good.
Good. You are the dramaturge for Bennett Fisher's play. Could you talk to us about that, please?
So I think of the dramaturg as the midwife in the birthing of a play. That's my easy go-to definition of what I do. So I'm the playwright's sounding board. I'm the advocate and representative of the play itself and the playwright. I'm a third eye for the team. I keep an eye on what is on continuity, clarity, authenticity, accuracy, and I keep an eye on the storytelling and represent the audience before the audience gets there.
Ah.
And sort of steer us all, keep us in line with our original goals and intentions, and make sure we all express ourselves as best we can while keeping story as the prime target.
So what role, as a new play evolves, who directs the team?
I like to say the play itself directs the team. That we all, at the end of the day, are in service to the play and what's best for the play. What's the best story? What's the story we're all trying to tell? And so theater is truly a collaboration. And we've been working very closely with our director, Becca Wolf, and we're the Bay Area Playwrights Festival creates these teams of trios. And we all have our own perspective or point of view, our own specialty when we work on a play, but we all serve the play itself. And so we ask what Ben wants, and Becca and I ask him questions about that to go deeper. I keep us steering towards, remember what we always wanted to do. This is what you originally changed the line to. How did it evolve from that to the new idea? And to talk about that a little bit. So we sort of move through the play like that with our actors throughout these rehearsal days.
This is probably a silly question, but what happens if a team of three has like a little personality conflict?
I always say the play wins. The play is the deciding factor.
Okay, very good.
I don't know if Ben agrees.
No, I mean, I think the writer is afforded a lot of power in the room. So the sad truth of the matter is that you can, you know, it's you still have, I guess, the authority to, you know, make whatever final decision gets made about the script or about the process. I think what's exciting about workshops like this, though, is that, you know, there's a point where really I like the phase in the collaborative process where it ceases to become my play and it becomes our play, where, you know, it really feels like informed by the voices that are there and where its meaning and its significance transcends what it means to the author. And I think this is eventually where you get in performance, right, where, mm-hmm. you know, when you're experiencing something in the theater, the author's intent or their vision is sort of immaterial. It's about what you're experiencing. Mm-hmm. And it's very liberating to see, you know, we're all working on plays that are in that transitional phase. Right. They've not yet reached production, but they're solid enough, they're shaped enough for other voices to really have a profound impact on them.
We've been talking with Bennett Fisher, Nakisa Etemad, Susanna Martin, and Hillary Bettis from the Bay Area Playwrights Festival, number 40. And this is ongoing through July 23rd at Custom Made Theater, 533 Sutter Street, in the heart of San Francisco's Theater District. Thank you very much. It's been a pleasure.
Thank you. Ooh. Ooh.
Talking now with Charlotte Moraga, artistic director of the newly formed Chitras Das Institute, which will be presenting their inaugural season, July 21st to 23rd, at Z Space. This is the first public performance of the CDI since the passing of the world-renowned Chitras Das passed away suddenly last January. Also joining us is tabla master Swapan Chowdhury with his instruments, or actually we have a tape so that we can play and you can hear. I am sort of at a loss here. Could you please explain to me what the is it Katak?
Katak, yes.
Katak. Could you explain us the history and the development of this, please?
Katak dance is one of 8 to 10 classical Indian dances. Happens to be from the subcontinent of India. Katak is from northern India. It has thousands of years of roots and history. Originally, for the divine, moved into the Mughal courts, where it became a highly refined classical art form and very sophisticated. And it continues to evolve today. I happened to serendipitously meet my Guruji, Pandit Chitras Das, in 1992 at San Francisco State University, where he was teaching a 2-credit course. And he is one of the premier master Katak dancers who's really been able to elevate and evolve the art form through innovation within tradition. So we're continuing that line. The Chitras Das Institute is devoted to developing the art form for the next generation, for the younger generation. And this concert is going to feature them, as well as the tradition, the Katak solo.
Oh, excellent. Now, I understand that it's not just dance and tabla. There's also verbal communication or verbal back and forth between the dancer and the musicians. Is that correct?
Yes, that's very correct. It's highly evolved rhythmically, and so I wear about 8 pounds of bells on the ankles. So essentially, I'm a musical instrument interacting with. Of course, this particular concert, we're extremely honored to have Pandit Swapan Chowdhury here. We've had a couple rehearsals, and the rehearsals have not really been rehearsals. They've been classes, like master classes. He will recite bowl after bowl. Now, bowl is the sound of a composition. And actually, if I may ask him to explain more about that, because he's the master in this area.
Oh, thank you, Charlotte. The bowls are what we... It's the phrases, and it's the only percussion instrument that has vast phrases, number of phrases, so we can make a story out of it, you know, so that you see the characters are coming in and out, and then they are telling their stories. So what I mean is that it's like a language. So if, suppose, when we are interacting with each other, me and Charlotte, when I am playing, she knows what phrase I am playing. And when she is dancing, I know what she is doing. So on the stage, it is nothing we prepared before. We just go there and listen to each other, and then we are reacting, interacting with each other, talking back and forth. So the bowl is that the phrase is a compositions. It's like a poetry, and that's what we are reciting. And when we are playing, we are trying to produce exact the same tone so that it matches with those phrases.
I gather from this that there is not necessarily improvisation, but a certain freedom. You're not repeating certain lines. So is there choreography? How do you learn, Charlotte, how did you learn this kind of this kind of dancing?
In a traditional solo, there's not much choreography. It's tremendously improvised. Learning when you learn in you learn through exercises, any kind of dance or music, you know, you do your scales, and in dance you do exercises, no matter what kind of dance it is. And those are choreographed steps. They happen to correspond to these bowls, these sounds, like so these are dance bowls. So if I can recite that, then I can dance that same pattern. So that, in a sense, is also a choreography, right? Because it's a composition.
Yes.
But there's many, many different kinds of movements you can have with that. There are some bowls that's a specific kind of movement, because as Shwapanda was saying, it's a story. So like this one particular one tune is like throwing a flower. So in that dance we have that, but in tabla it's a little different how they put them together. I don't know, Shwapanda, if you want to say something about that.
It's not that different. It's basically the same theory behind it. That how you have to or add it up all together so that it will make a sentence, basically. But each instrument or even our instrumental music or vocal music, we have wordings. So, and it's kind of selective. Like, for example, so in our tabla, it's like you are talking to with each other, you know. When you are very angry, and then if you want to be very sweet, so these are all different format, you know. And when we are on the stage, and that's how the improvisation starts. But we have freedom, but we are also very restrictive, because there are very strict rules and regulation that we have to maintain and follow when we do the improvising.
Well, let's listen to some of your work, please. talking today with Charlotte Moraga and Swapan Shidari?
Chowdhury.
Yeah. Sorry.
It's okay.
Oh, well. I would like to know a little bit more about the festival and participants and so on.
Okay, so this the concert, Art of Gattak, is really not just dance. It's not just Gattak dance. It's music. So we are so fortunate to have this incredible master playing tabla, but also we have Raginder Momi, who is playing violin, and he is a very up-and-coming, wonderful musician. And also Ben Kunin playing sarod. So it's full orchestra. It's a full orchestra. And we also have the Chitrashtas Youth Dance Company. And they will be dancing a choreographed piece, which is very intricate. And they will also be singing. I'm doing a work in progress, which is a small excerpt of a new work that's called Mantram, which is based on the Gayatri Mantram. Usually in Gattak, when we start the concert, we do an invocation to a particular god or goddess asking for blessings. But this particular mantram is not usually used in the dance because it is more for experiencing through the utterance liberation and enlightenment and a heightened sense of intelligence. So it's really, I'm trying to do it in a way that's experimental because I am focusing on vibration. Because Om is, it's the first sound in the universe, vibration. So this is a small, small piece. But most of the concert is the traditional solo, which is, as we were discussing, highly improvised.
I was watching one of your videos, and did I see a person playing a saxophone in one of the musicians? I think this was the trolley.
Yes, the San Francisco Trolley Dances. Yes, yeah. That was a work based on a Sufi poem. And yes, a saxophone is not traditionally an instrument used in Gattak, so we were, again... but, you know, this is a it's a conversation. The dance is, in its tradition, is really a conversation. So you can have a conversation with any musician, any dancer, any actor. It's a language, as Swapandal was saying. The bowls, it's a language. And rhythm is rhythm. So if you understand rhythm and you listen very carefully, and you want to, and you're curious, and you want to understand what someone is saying, you want to find out what is the story, then anyone can collaborate.
Right. Thank you. Could you speak more, please, about the role of the tabla player?
Well, tabla is... we are all musicians, so the role of tabla player, it's like... playing music and playing music with everybody. Music should be played by everybody, you know. So when we are playing tabla, we are either playing or accompanying. Tabla is an instrument, it's a percussion instrument, that it's not only an accompanying instrument, but it's also a solo instrument. So when I am playing, say, accompanying with some, say I am accompanying with Charlotte, then I will play a little differently. When I used to play Charlotte's guru, Chitresh Das, because we were childhood friend, we used to play a little differently. It's like more kind of challenging. But same thing when I played with Charlotte, I am very happy, and I have to tell you this, that I felt that she has that spark, that challenge. So it's a tabla player's role to mold themselves and go according to that. That's the role of tabla player, tabla player.
Very interesting. Thank you. We have tickets to give away. We have 3 pairs for the Friday show at 8 p.m. The theater is at Z Space, 450 Florida Street in San Francisco. So you should call 415-841-4444 4134. Three pairs of tickets for the Friday show. So we've been talking with Charlotte Moraga. No, is that right? I'm sorry. Charlotte Moraga and Swapan Chowdhury.
You are right.
Thank you, from the Chitras Das Institute. And I thank you very much, and I wish you the best of luck with the performances. It sounds wonderful. Thank you.
Thank you.
Thank you. Thank you for having us.
Thank you.
Hi, I'm Peter Robinson, and again, welcome to Open Air. Also, welcome to Judith, who's been standing in very nobly this week for David Latulli. And one thing I like about Pink Martini, it's that kind of soothing, low-key background, which sometimes I find myself reading to. So today, in this early segment, I'm going to be looking and talking about some deck chair reading. If you're thinking of heading out to Stinson Beach, you're going to sit down under the sunshade, stretch your feet, unfold a book, and let the waves talk to you. And we may not know this here in this country, but certainly the rest of the world does. This is the 200th anniversary of the death of Jane Austen. So my first set of segments really relates to not just her novels, but also something that the various critics have had to say about her writing. Now, should you be travelling to the UK this summer, you may be surprised to find that if you purchase a £10 note, that is a note worth approximately $15, you will find Jane Austen's face on the actual note. So there we are. She's replaced the Queen, not the Queen of England, but certainly the Queen of Literature. Welcome to 2000-year celebration of Jane Austen. A little bit about her background, because I think it's useful to know. She was actually born in December 1775 in the small Hampshire village of Stevenson, and the daughter of a provincial clergyman. As a teenager, and then later in life, she would go on to publish Pride and Prejudice, Emma, Mansfield Park, Sense and Sensibility, and all in their own way, observations about the middle and upper classes of Regency England. Now, some of the questions I think people may ask, because her father could not afford education, so where indeed did she get her knowledge from? And the quick answer was his library. So he let her loose in the library, and what did we get? We got these wonderful, wonderful books, which have not just got a British quality to them, but during my research I've discovered that two countries where the books are most translated, one is China and the other is Japan, and they both have Jane Austen societies. And I think one reason for the appeal there is not simply to do with marriage, but to do with what I call the classification of society, where there is a sense of order, a sense of well-being, and I don't say they always do it, but they're pretty well-behaved, except on those very, very rare occasions. So that's one area of appeal. Here in this country, just this week, for example, there is a one-person ladies' show in Chicago based on both the letters and the novels a person is doing, so we can go over to Chicago, or else you can go to Bologna, Italy, where they've now founded a Jane Austen society. For some people, you know, the books alone are not just the story, but largely thanks to the BBC, we can see Jane Austen novels in full flesh on the screen, on the television. And many people remember the 1995 version with Colin Firth playing Mr. Darcy, and he comes strolling out of the lake in a wet shirt, a scene you'll not find in any of her books. So there you go again. Sometimes taking artistic liberty is how things happen. Now, they're also issuing a set of stamps with her face on them, so when you go to the post office in England, you can send your friend a Jane Austen letter with a Jane Austen stamp on it. And back at Cambridge, my old stamping ground, the Lucy Cavendish College is actually reenacting the Netherfield Ball. So there you have it. You have everything from the past to the present. In the outbacks of Australia, they have a Jane Austen book, although I'm sure the language they use is not being quite as raffined as she is in her writing. So this takes me back to the question about universal truths. Interesting enough, back on that £10 note again, in the background is, of course, Mrs. Bennet, who employs that great British understatement, "You have delighted us long enough," which is a great conversation killer for somebody who talks too much. So this is an interesting time. Now, let me give you a couple of titles, if you're interested, not just in the books, but also in some of the studies that go with them. The first is a new book by Devona Loser called The Making of Jane Austen. It's published by John Hopkins University Press. Then there is Helena Kelly, Jane Austen, The Secret Radical. And I think these books are interesting because people can take totally opposite positions when it comes to understanding Jane Austen. You could argue that she's an arch-conservative, she believes in order. And you can also take the other viewpoint, which was particularly prevalent in the early part of the 20th century, that she is an ardent feminist and stands essentially for the rights of women. Her own life story is interesting because she did have offers of marriage, but she essentially saw herself dedicated to writing, and so that was her prime choice. Two other books, one is by Marilyn Butler, Jane Austen and the War of Ideas, and I think that's the great gift of what she offers. Plenty to provoke you, plenty to think about, and if you're in a book club, plenty to discuss. And then more a kind of at-home series, Jane Austen at Home by Lucy Worsley. And this is an interesting background as you wander around the artifacts and collections that you may have found in a Jane Austen household. So that's my first look at how things are going in the magic world of books, the world of reading. And if you are a Jane Austen fan, or your book club over the last couple of years has read a Jane Austen novel, these studies, I think, will give you additional insights. The first, Devona Loser, called The Making of Jane Austen. The second, Helena Kelly, Jane Austen, The Secret Radical. Then Marilyn Butler, Jane Austen and the War of Ideas, and Lucy Worsley, Jane Austen at Home. Plenty to think about there, plenty to read, and certainly plenty to provoke an interesting conversation. And I always think, it's worth having one Jane Austen quote, which always keeps me on my toes. Every man is surrounded by a neighborhood of voluntary spies. Every man is surrounded by a neighborhood of voluntary spies. So look over your shoulder as you sit in that deck chair, see who's watching you, and see whether they are listening to what they think you are reading. And now we're going to move on to an interesting dual biography. It has just come out. It's by a military historian, but this time it is not necessarily about military history. And it is Ricks. The title is Orwell and Churchill, or I should put it the other way around, Churchill and Orwell, and the author Thomas Ricks. Now, first, these two major 20th century celebrities, characters, politicians, writers, call them what you will, do not appear as normal, straightforward, I'm not going to use the word friends, they seem in fact like strange bedfellows. But the subtitle of the book, The Fight for Freedom, I think gives us the clue. And they are both, in their own ways, very similar in many of their outlooks. Both at different points have been war correspondents. Churchill during the Boer War, and then George Orwell during the Spanish Civil War. And they both straddled, interestingly enough, both sides of the political fence, from being to the right and then to the left and then to the middle and then back to the right and back to the left again. So you've got some similarities going in that context. And I think they're both particularly relevant in today's age, the age of Trump. I did say Trump. I didn't say dump the Trump. I said Trump by mistake. So there we have it. George Orwell, of course, in 1984, is very much talking about how we view privacy, how we view ourselves, what do we need to know about each other. And, of course, in Animal Farm, he's talking about the nature of equality and are men all equal. Churchill, on the other hand, made that very critical speech at Fulton in 1945, recognising the Iron Curtain. In fact, that was a turning point in understanding how the Cold War opened. And then, for different reasons, at the end of this interesting dual biography, Orwell and Churchill, Bricks goes into a very interesting tradition. And what I'm going to do is just read a section which I think what makes the book so interesting. They acted on their beliefs, they responded with courage and clear-sightedness. If sometimes they were wrong in their judgment, their determination, particularly in times of national crisis, ultimately triumphed. And what he does is trace a tradition which goes from Aristotle to Locke to Hume and finally takes us through Orwell and Churchill to Martin Luther King's letter from a Birmingham jail and sees how the importance of speaking out, defending human rights, recognising the importance of freedom, above all freedom of speech, is really critical. So if you're a historian, if you're interested in the social, political conditions of the 20th century, a strong recommendation, Tom Ricks' book, Churchill and Orwell. And I'm going to finish in this book section with something totally different, a book which has just been released. It's called Quiet Until the Thaw. It's by Alexandra Fuller, and it is set on a Lakota Sioux reservation. Now, people may remember her because of the cocktail hour under the tree of forgetfulness. And again, this is really a story written as a novel. Her previous memoirs have been literally nonfiction. They have been memoirs. But this particular book traces the life and the difference between two particular Native Indians, both Lakotas. And here is an exciting name, Rick Overlooking Horse, and the other was You Choose Watson. One is a totally silent person. So she's created a story set on an Indian reservation which embraces thoughts about silence. And the other, on the other hand, is very much the overtalker, garrulous, and a troubled life. So this is a good insight on another way of thinking, another way of being. And one of the interests to Fuller, I think, in this particular book is the nature of time, whether you accept linear time or whether you are more into something totally different, cyclical time, as time comes around. It's a book about respect for nature, and it's interesting in a very different style for a novel, because some chapters are approximately a page and a half. So you keep the story going, you keep the core story flowing. On the other hand, she is a very economic writer. So that's something different if you're heading to the beach. The title, one more time, Under the Thaw, the author, Alexander Fuller. And that is my reading segment for today. Enjoy good reading, enjoy the outside doors, but keep your eyes on the page.
We'll meet again. Don't know where, don't know when, but I know we'll meet again some sunny day. Keep smiling through, just like you always do, till the blue skies drive.
Well, there you have it, the immortal voice of Vera Lynn. And why do we use it? Well, I've just been to see the movie Dunkirk. So for anyone who goes back to those war years, now is born within 1 year of that turning point in certainly British and European history, Vera Lynn, and we'll meet again. We'll meet again if you're lucky, because we're talking about who came back and who didn't come back. So Christopher Nolan's new movie, Dunkirk, is certainly, I think, going to be one of those summer blockbusters that really looks at those critical days on the beaches. But before I go into the review, let me say a little bit about putting the story, and it is a movie, into more of a historic context. By May 1940, France was on the eve of capitulation. In Britain, Neville Chamberlain, the Prime Minister, had just resigned. Winston Churchill had just come to power. And there in Europe, stranded, were 450,000 British expeditionary troops waiting one way or the other to be brought home. So that is the background to the story. And the reason I bring up those contexts is that the way Nolan has chosen to make this film is to present it through really three different eyes. One is the eyes of a fighter pilot, and this is the era where Spitfires and Hurricanes were the planes of the period. The second is through this expeditionary force. Mark Rylance plays the owner of a small boat, and this whole flotilla was put together almost within 2 or 3 days to sail across the channel and pick up troops from the beaches at Dunkirk. Now, let me say, too, something briefly about the beaches of Dunkirk is the way the beach actually approaches the water is so shallow that the major ships, the destroyers and the other ones, could not get in. So you were totally dependent on these little boats, all manned by volunteers as they cross the channel to rescue the troops heading back hopefully to England. And the third eye that he looks things through is an infantryman from the Durham Light Infantry, one of the people stranded on those beaches. So seen in that context, it is the story in three different ways of what happened over that very critical turning point moment in history. And I think he's high on patriotism, he's high on flag waving, he's high on nationalism, he's high on emotion. And when I spoke to him several years ago, he did tell me that one of his influences was Alfred Hitchcock. So there is an element of suspense as we cut from a Spitfire charging in for a dogfight with a German Messerschmitt. We move in on the faces of the troops as they try to wade out into the channel, and then we move back to the face of the person in the small boat who's hoping to conduct a rescue. I hate to admit it, were hearing aids, but if you're going to this particular movie, you may want earplugs, because here we have gunfire. We have planes crashing into the sea. In fact, it's a movie of very little dialogue, which I think is kind of interesting, because it's in many ways a treat for the eyes, and certainly something that you will come out at the very end hoping, but you don't get it, the words of Winston Churchill, "We'll meet them on the beaches." And we don't meet them on the beaches, but in fact, what we have is reading the headlines. So my movie suggestion for this week, this summer, take it all in. It's called Dunkirk. It's by Christopher Nolan, and it's playing at the Kabuki and many of the theatres around the Bay Area.
That's Open Air for this week. I've been your host, Judith Seeger, sitting in for David LaTulipe. A reminder, all of our shows are archived at kalw.org. Just search for Open Air or a guest's name. If you have a suggestion for a guest, please send an email to david@kalw.org. My thanks again to producer Neil Swinkles and board engineer Ashley Ann King Krigbaum. And thank you all for listening. Bye-bye.